Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Peter Hirschfeld, in for Jane Lindholm. The emergency room is usually one of the busiest places in any hospital, but you might be surprised to find out that emergency medicine, as a specialty at least, is a relatively new development in the medical industry. ERs used to be staffed by a rotating crew of doctors who worked shifts there regardless of what their medical specialty actually was. And Dr. Paul Seward, who lives in Middlebury now, is one of the first physicians in the country to become an emergency specialist. Dr. Seward is with us in the Colchester studio today. Doctor, thanks for coming in to talk about your book.
It's a privilege.
This book is a compilation of stories from your nearly 50-year career as a medical professional. You tell us right off the bat that your goal with this book is to, quote, tell the reader what it's like to work in an emergency room. And you say that you don't just mean what happens in an emergency room, but what it actually feels like to work in an emergency room. Presumably, you think there's some value in people who are not doctors understanding what that feeling is. What is that value to you?
Well, as you just pointed out, the emergency department's a scary place. And it's also a place that has lots of connotations, and it's been glorified in fact and fiction. But part of that is, who are these people who are taking care of me? Do they really care about me? As an old friend of mine once said, people don't care what you know unless they know that you care. And what I wanted to convey is that this is a profession that is practiced by human beings. And I don't just limit that to doctors. I mean nurses, the x-ray techs, everybody who's working in an ER is a person with the foibles and strengths of people. But they're all there because they think it's an important place to be and because they care about people.
Yeah, you know, I guess we don't really often think about what's going on in the interior of the doctor's brain when we go to seek medical care. Maybe mm-hmm. that's because we're focused at that moment on what ails us. Mm-hmm. Each chapter in this book recounts a specific story, most of which take place within the confines of whatever emergency room you were working in at the time. And we should note here, you've worked in hospitals literally all over the country. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by your decision to start the book with the story that you did. It's the case of a 22-year-old man who arrives with an acute infection, not a particularly complicated diagnosis for you to make. Also, you're able to decide on a course of treatment that, if gone through with, would return him to relatively full health. There's something about this patient, though, that causes you to ponder a different approach to his care. Can you tell folks what you did in that situation and why?
Yeah, this was a young man who had been normal till he was about 19 years old, but then he was involved in an altercation for some reason, was hit on the head with a pipe, had excellent neurosurgical care, but did not wake up, and was unresponsive and in what's called a vegetative state, and had been such for the last 2 or 3 years. And there was no hope for his recovery from that. And therefore, I wanted to, seeing as he could not tell me what his human need was, what his ethical need was, I wanted to involve his mother, who was his legal guardian also, in the decision of whether or not to do the aggressive care that would be needed to save his life, or to allow this to be a moment in which he could die.
This isn't the only chapter where you broach some interesting ethical questions about the role doctors play in death and dying. And what was interesting to me is this is a book about an emergency room physician, somebody we presumably tend to associate with the saving of lives. And you did start with this story about somebody that – it was a story about death. And there are other stories of Father Allen, the Episcopal priest, who against your advice decides to attend a dinner with longtime friends instead of staying overnight for observation, as you said he ought to. You warned him if he doesn't stay overnight, there's a good chance he might die from a heart attack as a result of that decision. – he goes to see his friends anyway, says, they're in town. I may never have this opportunity again. And Father Allen dies, I believe it was of a heart attack, before the next morning. The moral of the story, though, I got the sense, was not, that's why you should always listen to your doctor, folks. You seem to be delivering a more complicated message than that. And I almost got the sense from your writing that you thought maybe Father Allen made the right call for him.
That's not for me to decide. That was for Father Allen to decide. You know, obviously, if he had been a 10-year-old boy, I might have been, I would not have allowed such a decision. But he was alert, fully intact, had a, and I made sure he had a complete knowledge of the risks he was taking, and he chose to, and it wasn't just a party, by the way. It was a party in his honor and in honor of other people.
An event that was clearly of
clearly
great
a one of a kind,
yeah.
And he'd traveled a long way to be there, and it was not going to happen again. And he was also quite elderly. And I don't think he went there thinking, I'm going to die because of this. I think he went there thinking, this is important. Life is full of danger. I'll take this risk.
You say in the book, Dr. Seward, that, quote, humans have more than medical problems. You say, and I'm going to quote you again here, what about ethical questions, quality of life questions? What about spiritual or religious questions? And who should be involved in both asking and answering those questions when clearly the patient can no longer do so? These are some really big questions that you're asking here that kind of get at the heart of who we are as people very generally. Is the medical community getting the answers to those questions right, do you think?
I think I say right after that, and let me read. Let me say up front that over 30 years later, I do not pretend to know the answers. But even then, I knew that not knowing the answers did not excuse me from having to provide them. Whether or not I wanted to be, I was the person who had the knowledge and authority to act on his behalf. Whatever I did for this young man, or refrained from doing, was a responsibility I could not avoid. I had chosen to be here. I had worked and studied for many years to be here. I had been hired by the hospital and was paid well to be precisely in this position, to make these decisions and to choose correctly. And I think that's the principal point. If you wait to have someone who is sure, if you wait to have someone who knows all the answers, first of all, you've waited for the wrong person, because a lot of what emergency medicine is about is a tolerance for uncertainty. There is no perfect amount of information, either medically. I mean, everything I was taught in medical school turned out to be wrong. Not quite, but most of it. Or ethical choices, et cetera. But you are not excused from answering them, and the patient is not excused from answering them. They have to be answered. Do I think people do it well? I think by and large, 95% of the time, and 95% of the people involved, and I'm going to use the word doctor to include PAs and to include all the other people who are in a caretaking position, make those decisions correctly and make them well. And if they're not perfect, they're certainly human and good. We tend to hear about the 5%.
It is odd and interesting to me that emergency medicine is a new-ish medical specialty. Intuitively, I guess I just thought that would be the first one, right? I mean, what would people naturally go to the doctor for? Well, I have this broken bone or something sticking out of me. Can we take care of this? Apparently not, though. Why was this specialty so late in coming, and how has emergency medicine as a specialty evolved since you became a part of it?
I think you're quite right. It is the oldest form of medicine. And if you look in the Odyssey or the Iliad, you'll find healthcare being provided on the battlefield. And I was struck by the fact that Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem called Gunga Din, in which he's basically, in my mind, the first EMT. However, what we're talking about is not so much providers, but qualified providers in a system in which the science and the technology have been brought up to the speed of what it is in other areas of medicine. And what made us do that really was war. World War II, of course, but especially the Vietnam War. And even to this day, over wars, people would come home from those wars, so returning servicemen, and say, I got better care, you know, in Iraq or in Vietnam than I can get in my own hometown for emergency things. And so I think that was put a lot of pressure on everybody to get it right.
We have a call from Scott, who's in Brattleboro. Scott, I gather you have a emergency room experience of your own to share.
Yes. Actually, when I was 23 years old, I had just moved to New York City, and I was hit by a cab the first day that I was there. And it was a hit and run. And by the time I made it to the St. Vincent's Hospital emergency room, there was a huge crowd there, mostly people with colds and stuff, it seemed to me. And I sat there for a long time. Finally, I had to tell the nurse, you know, the bone was almost through my arm. I said, you know, if you don't give me a gurney, I'm going to pass out. So they put me on a gurney, and they took me into a room. And after a while, a doctor came in. He had no one to help him, so he put my fingers in clamps and put weights on my arms and had me stay there about 45 minutes being tortured. It came back in. Nothing had happened. So he went to push the bone into place. I said, I know enough about this. You don't push it into place. You pull it into place. And he said, if I had someone to help me, I'd pull it into place. But I'm going to do it this way, and it's going to be okay.
Scott, thanks for the story. It sounds like you might have suffered some undue pain there as a result of the fact that the doctor perhaps didn't have the human resources he needed, Dr. Seward, to do his job appropriately. You talk about this issue in the book. You say, look, most hospitals have a lot to be proud of when it comes to their emergency departments and how they're run. But you say you yourself have been in situations where people were overworked and there just weren't enough of them.
Well, my personal worst was I worked the night shift on Christmas Eve. I always liked doing that because Tiny Tim always came in and we mostly got him well. At about 5 o'clock in the morning, I had 26 people in the ER, of which two were quite critical, and I was sort of running back and forth between them. And I'd called in one of my associates, but my associates came from a long way. It was just me and the help of some very good nurses and very good ancillary personnel. And that's what it is. And my comment, although that wasn't the original thing, is that you're talking about something else which is also near and dear to my heart, which is that now that we've built this wonderful emergency medicine system, staffing, training, academic things where we can do things that we just couldn't do before, we've decided as a nation to use that as the chewing gum and duct tape for a failed healthcare system.
You actually have a line in your book where you say people often ask you, when is the American healthcare system going to collapse? And you say, my answer to them is it already has. Mm-hmm. And it's we don't really realize it because emergency departments allow us to mask this reality.
And actually, I just wrote an article about that in a recent journal. And I would compare it to putting a snowplow on a Porsche. It's a really bad idea because, first of all, it does a bad job. And secondly, it's a really, really expensive way to plow. And thirdly, it trashes the Porsche. And I think what this gentleman was up against was the fact that the Porsche was being trashed by the fact that lots of people who had no other place to go for minor illnesses were coming to the ER. I see that not as a problem caused by hospitals or caused by patients. Most of us and most hospitals do the best they can with what they have. But I do think that it's an attempt to address a problem that would take two or three other radio programs worth of talking to.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Seward today. He's just written a new book about his nearly 50-year career as an emergency room physician. You say you think the American healthcare system has collapsed. It's a pretty sobering assessment. What do you mean exactly?
Well, what I mean is – and it's not collapsed. I mean, it's sort of lying on the floor half dead and struggling to run the computer. Here's some statistics. The majority of the bankruptcies in this country, personal bankruptcy, not business bankruptcies, occur when one spouse has a terminal illness and dies and leaves the other spouse with horrendous medical bills. No other country, no other developed country would even understands how that could be. That indeed, for many people who are trapped, you know, a little too much money for Medicaid, not enough money to have health insurance, find themselves unable to get medical care and have to come to the ER for things that they themselves know could be solved in other ways and therefore jam the system. The failure of our country to provide good medical insurance to everyone is, I think, a crime. I think the reasons for it are complex and not particularly.
Natalie is on the line from Wheelock. Natalie, tell us about your emergency room experience.
Well, I've had really good experiences, really bad experiences, but I truly believe that they are doing the very best that they can. And I'm grateful that there's an emergency room that I can go to if I need help.
Is that generally the sentiment, Dr. Seward, that you see from patients that, this may not be ideal, but I sure am glad it's a place I can come to when I need to?
I think so. I mean, basically, people who work in the ER are like everybody else. You know, 5% of the people who are there are saints. I don't limit this to physicians by any sense. Both physicians are not saints. And yes, there are people there who are perhaps more unfeeling than they should be or are there for the wrong sorts of reasons. But all the rest are normal people who go home to their families, get real tired of working night shifts and things like that, and then come to work and try to do the best they can. And they chose that profession as opposed to being a hedge fund manager, say, because they thought it was important and thought what happened in emergency departments is important. And I've always been gratified by the kinds of things that people will say and do. And it takes, in my experience, it actually takes very little. I get a huge reward for saying hello in a kind of – in a nice way, which sounds kind of odd. I think people do care. I think patients perceive that they care. I think patients perceive most of the time that the problem is not caused by the people taking care of them. And I think the other events are unfortunate, inevitable in a large number of so many patients. But by and large, I think – and by the way, let me thank the – a person who called in for her kind words. Kind words go a long way.
You said you were careful to say in most cases the problem the patient is experiencing is not because of the doctor or the person administering the care. But you write very candidly in this book about some of the mistakes that you've made, mm-hmm. some of the mistakes that people on your medical team have made that you've mm-hmm. witnessed. And some of them are pretty tough to read. There was a story of a nurse who inadvertently severed the thumb of a baby that had been born very yes. prematurely. There's an instance in which you decide to give a young child a spinal tap and very nearly kill him in the process. I was reminded reading these stories of a study that came out of Johns Hopkins in 2016 mm-hmm. that said the CDC should classify medical errors as the third leading cause of death in the United States, which shocked me. They mm-hmm. say you could attribute 250,000 lives lost a year to medical errors. Talk to me about protocol in hospitals, how you deal with errors when they happen, and how you as an individual or you as a staff come to terms emotionally, medically, and then also legally with the outcome mm-hmm. of some of these mistakes.
Well, first of all, a hospital is a dangerous place. just because of the kinds of things we do. We give people horrible poisons to try to cure them. We stick sharp objects in their bodies. We put them through, in that one case, physical positions that are not particularly comfortable or sometimes are unsafe. And we do so on the basis of decisions about what's going on that are imperfect. The human body is a really complex place, and it's requires both a lot of knowledge and a lot of good judgment and sometimes good fortune to make it through. This being said, we do have ways to look at errors. There's the director of the ER usually will be reviewing charts, and in fact, all ER physicians review each other's charts in most ERs, just to and certainly a sample of them. And we'll have all the ERs I worked in. We had monthly meetings where we discussed not only information and education, but also went over charts and problems. And if there's some area of problem, we'd have educational seminars about it. The existence of the malpractice system is a mixed blessing. There are certainly situations in which it is an important avenue for people who have been injured to get some recompense, even only to return partially to their life, the normal life or their new normal life. The problem with malpractice is that it requires that somebody be proven wrong, and no fault system, I think, would be much better where the recompense is based on the degree of injury rather than on who proving that someone caused it, because that makes people much more reluctant to look at their errors. But we do look at our errors. Should the concept of medical error be something that the CDC classifies in studies? Frankly, I thought they already were.
Johanna is calling from Middlebury. Johanna, I gather you read Dr. Seward's book and you have a question for him.
Yes, I really enjoyed this book. I think it's really important. And what it raised for me was the question, when I need emergency medical care and I go to an emergency room, are there some things that I should be aware of for my own safety?
Yes. And I'm glad you asked me that question, Johanna. The most important thing that you should be aware of is, like it or not, you're in charge. You will not think you're in charge. A lot of things will be done to indicate that you are a passenger in your own healthcare, but that's not the case. And in particular, you have to be prepared to ask what's happening to you. To ask questions, to ask, how come I haven't seen the doctor? You don't have to be angry at that. But if you are going through a set of procedures or a system, you should know before something is done to you why it's being done, what is the diagnostic reason for it, and whether or not you are okay with that. Doctors, how shall I put it? People are afraid to ask doctors questions. But if you are questioning your doctor about what's going on and your doctor is, I'm the doctor, you know, you have no business answering that question, get another doctor. And I know that's hard to do in the ER, but your best defense, in a nutshell, is your ability to demand that you understand what's going on.
One of the things we talk about as being part and parcel of emergency rooms in Vermont these days is the mental health crisis. And we've seen a real influx of mental health patients in ERs for lack of a proper bed in a psychiatric hospital somewhere. These are people experiencing acute episodes, stuck in ERs, horribly equipped to deal with them, in some cases for 4 or 5 days. Was this something that you had to deal with in your work as an ER physician? And is there something we're not doing right now as a state to remediate this situation that we ought to be?
Truth in Advertising, you should know that when I was the medical director at Adirondack Medical Center's emergency department a number of years ago, my wife was the director of the geriatric psych unit as a geriatric psych nurse. And we had a number of conversations about this, that, and the other thing. It's not that the ER is not equipped to deal with mental health patients most of the time. Most of the time we have on call a person who is psychiatrically trained who can come and assess patients. We most of the time have a room in which they are safe, in which they can't hang themselves or stab themselves or smash their heads on the corner of a desk or do otherwise harm themselves. And mostly we can make some kind of a disposition. Where the system breaks down is that there may be no disposition that they can go to. It may be that the psychiatric hospital, as it was for AMC, because the psychiatric unit at AMC is only for people 65 or over, and there's some pretty severe licensing regulations about that. But we had to send people many miles by ambulance to another facility for inpatient care, or we had to watch them in the ER. That's I guess I'm arguing that on behalf of the psychiatric community that that's kind of a system failure. We used to have real psychiatric hospitals, but back in the early part of the Reagan era, they all got defunded and closed down. And so now the chance of the availability of good inpatient care for psychiatric patients is much, much more restricted than it used to be.
Mary is calling from Burlington. Mary, what's your question?
Yes. I was very intrigued that you said in medical school you learned some things that were vastly different from the reality of the ER. Could you expound on that?
Well, it's not so much that they were vastly different from the reality of the ER, but they were systemically – you have to understand, you don't learn how to be a doctor in medical school. You learn a lot of science in medical school, and you follow – doctors around, and those are teaching hospitals and things like that. Then you go out and practice with enough information to now begin learning how to be a doctor. And for a lot of people, in fact, back in the old day, the ER was a place that was staffed by surgical residents in training and maybe some medical residents in training, and that's how you thought it was. But then you go out to we would go out to the local hospitals, and oops, us. We're the emergency physicians. I started as a pediatrician that way. The content of the science, how the content of the science has changed is really it's become deeper. It's not so much that it's wrong, but we've discovered that a lot of things are caused by antigen antibody things or can be caused by inflammatory processes that we didn't understand back then. That doesn't change the ER thing very much. But it does change medicine. I think the things that have changed markedly in the emergency room is, one, our ability to intubate patients, which is to take a tube and put it in your windpipe so you can breathe. We weren't allowed to do that for the first 15 years of my practice because the medicines to do it correctly are very dangerous. So we had to develop internally training so that we were trained to use those medicines. I think there's a lot of imaging techniques that were not available. We kind of had to do physical exams. My gosh, think about that. That now we can do things. Those are the major differences.
John is calling from Norwich. John, what do you want to add to this conversation?
I just wanted to express some appreciation as a semi-retired physician for your very effective, I think, description of the inevitable uncertainty and the reasons for it in medical care. I think in general, I had the privilege and challenge as a medical resident many years ago of covering a lot of shifts in the what was often the second busiest emergency room in New York City. So on.
Which one?
Having flashbacks of it as you're talking, but I've for years described to medical students medicine as the art of making life-critical decisions with inevitably inadequate information. You can never know enough to be sure, and I just wanted to appreciate your description of that in a way that I think makes sense out of it.
And may I appreciate your description of it as well? Which hospital were you in New York?
Look, sounds like we lost.
St. Luke's? Okay. I did some time, in brief time at New York downtown in another life. Thank you. You're very kind. You've obviously been there, done that. And thank you for that.
So is the pressure coming from patients on doctors to have all the answers or to pretend like they have all the answers? Or is the pressure that John is talking about a pressure that doctors put on themselves because they feel like they're supposed to have all the answers, they need to have all the answers because they're the ones that have to do something about this problem?
I think that patients understand very well that medical knowledge is not perfect and that doctors are not perfect. I think what people want in a doctor is a doctor who's as good as he can be in terms of being trained, et cetera, and then who cares? And it's hard to show someone that you care when you've been up all night and you've had a fight with your wife and the last two patients had said bad things to you, et cetera. People, and also when you've got 14 people waiting to see you, but it can be done. And I think if I get back to this, and I'm not making this statement that I think this is necessarily true of all patients, but patients have made this statement to me so often that if they know that you're bright and you care, then they're willing to go with you.
We have time for another call from Peter, who's calling from Charlotte. Peter, what's on your mind?
Hi. Just to expand on that last point, I think patients have a fast food mentality when it comes to their health care. And it's not always like that in the ER. And I, too, appreciate the ER and know when I have to wait to be seen is a good reason for it, called triage. But my main point is that I think as a retired primary care PA, I think in the office, oftentimes under the pressure of seeing 20, 25 patients a day, we may have a problem that just is a little bit too complicated or it was going to take too much time. So the result is go to the ER. When in fact, primary care providers, I think, could be and should be handling a lot of the things that get kicked over. That's my point.
My son is a primary care PA in Virginia. And he would agree with you completely, and thank you for that. I'm very grateful for what you guys do.
Dr. Paul Seward, real pleasure to have had you on the program today. We appreciate you being with us.